This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Growing up in Ohio, Melody Moisey sat through her father's lengthy recitations of the poetry of 13th century Muslim poet Maulana, otherwise known as Rumi. For Melody's father, Rumi's rich, textured language brought him back to the Iran he loved and had to flee. For her, Rumi's mysticism was counterpoint to the American values and identity she picked up in school. Then she experienced a psychotic breakdown. In her book, The Rumi Prescription, How an Ancient Mystic Poet Changed My Modern Manic Life, Melody highlights the nuances of Rumi's diagnosis of insanity in comparison to the U.S. medical system. Melody's an attorney and a visiting assistant professor at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and is on our show now. Welcome back. Good day.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me more about this book and about Rumi's significance in your life.
Well, he was an inescapable presence in my life growing up, and I call my dad in the book a Rumi addict. And like most children of addicts, I grew up resenting the object of my father's addiction. And like most children, right, I just thought I was smarter than my parents and that I knew better, of course. And it took about 30 years for me to figure out I was definitely not smarter than them, and they knew better than me. And to be able to have them alive in that moment where I could reclaim that inheritance was such a gift because, you know, this is the kind of inheritance that you cannot claim after death, right? And if I wanted to learn this poetry in the Persian, the classical medieval Persian that it was in, I would have to do it through my father. There was no other way for me to do it.
Now, was he, you know, running around the house citing these quotations? I mean, how did it actually work?
So if you have a conversation with him, it's funny, I was doing a talk the other day and someone was like, oh, my dad was in the audience. And they were like, can he stand up and recite something? And immediately he's like, no, I don't want to do any of that. And I think what it comes up naturally in conversation. So for any situation where a lesson was necessary, there was a poem to go with that situation. And it was always recited in Persian and in the classical Persian in the original poetry. But then he had to, because my Farsi is so bad, he had to translate it into modern day Farsi and then sometimes into English, too, if I didn't know what he was.
So you had to hear it three times.
Basically.
Yeah.
At least. Yeah.
And so initially a giant eye roll. Did any of it sort of, I mean, did the appropriateness of the lines, you know, it's like, yeah, I get it. You know, be kind to, you know, do unto.
Yeah.
Those who...
You know, you absorb it. I think I absorbed it growing up. And this lesson of my religion was always education. My religion was always love. Even though I grew up in a Muslim family, we very much because of my parents being from Iran, a lot of Iranians have, particularly Muslim Iranians like me, have very conflicted relationships with Islam because the government has appropriated it, misappropriated it, specifically to say this is what Islam is. But the Islam I know is the Islam I grew up with, which is the Islam of Rumi. And partly what I wanted to do with this book is bring that back and to remind the people who are so in love with Rumi on Instagram or Pinterest or whatever, this poet you love so much, you should also know that he was a Muslim refugee. He was an Iranian. Before you start hating us, before it's okay for you to hate us, imagine, can you hate him? That's my culture. That's where I come from. So my hope is with the book that I can help people respect and appreciate the culture and the history from which this poetry has come.
When did that appreciation come to you?
Well, I had to lose my mind for that to happen. I had an acute manic episode and a psychotic break. And I very much believe in medication and modern medicine. My parents are both physicians. I was very grateful for the existence of antipsychotics, but there was a part of that experience that was very mystical and similar to how you hear people describe psychedelic experiences. But I had never used any drugs like that. But my brain naturally went there and I had a beautiful mystical experience where I felt deeply connected to the beloved and to every other human being and living thing on Earth in a way I hadn't before. But then quickly that descended into clinical madness, which needed medical treatment. I just wish that the medical system had recognized that when I said there was a part of this that was spiritual for me, that they wouldn't say that's garbage. And likewise, I wish, you know, my faith community wouldn't have said that the medical side of it was garbage. I think there's a moment where we can connect the two and be able to say these two things are not mutually exclusive. You can take medicine, you can believe in science, and you can also believe in the power of poetry and love.
Did any of the memory or the feeling of that mystical experience linger?
You know, humans are so forgetful.
Yeah.
It did. But, you know, there's a reason in so many faiths, what in Islam, we're supposed to pray, what, 5 times a day? Mm. You know, Shias like me are a little lazy. We'll do 3 times a day sometimes. But the reason you're supposed to pray so much is because people are so forgetful. Right. You know, it's so easy to have this beautiful experience and then just forget it. And for me, that the memory of there being something greater than me that lives within me and within all of us, that lingered. But can I forget it for 3 seconds when I'm mad at you? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've always felt that the message of universal love and acceptance is like oral hygiene. Like, okay, great, but you can't brush your teeth for an hour and a half on Sunday and think you'll never have to do it again.
Exactly.
If you plan to eat, you're going to have to keep brushing and eating and brushing and eating. And
absolutely.
That's what being in the real world, material world does for you. Give me a sample of, let's give us all a sample so we can get some Rumi in our ear and then talk more about his significance.
Sure. Is there any part in particular?
I've marked a couple.
Okay.
If you didn't have any picked out.
Yeah, let me know.
I've got 2 marked, and I'd rather have you read them than me.
I hear
enough of me.
So these are translations by me with the help of my father. I picked the English. He helped me through the Farsi. So, the Beloved has expanded your heart with divine light, yet you still seek answers from outside to feel right. You are a fathomless lake, yet you complain of drought incessantly. Why settle for a puddle when you have a channel to the sea? And here's another one. As usual, we're drunk with love today. Evict your thoughts and find a song to play. Prayers and devotions come in countless shapes and sizes. Pick the ones the beauty in your soul recognizes.
Rumi is, and I should point out that I'm talking today to Melody Moisey, who is the author of The Rumi Prescription, and we're talking to her about her book and about her relationship with Rumi and his work. There's a lot of that drunkenness and sort of erotic love that gets blended with this deeper sense of ineffable love in Rumi's poetry, which at times puts him at odds with religious leadership, not the religion itself. As you say, the religion is love,
right.
And anybody who knows about Muslim Islam would know that. But religious leaders have a way of wanting to accumulate power, and universal love doesn't help that. Because if you don't have to do something for me in order to be loved, I lose power,
Which
is how religions get formed. But talk about his relationship with the religion, because there are times when there's tension.
Right. You know, I mean, he was an Islamic scholar and a respected jurist, but people misinterpreted his poetry in terms of being, you know, his poetry is absolutely about love, and it's about love between and among humans. It's about love with humans and animals, among animals. It's about a greater love that is hard for us to understand as human beings, as souls that were put in these human bodies, and sort of for as long as we're here, we're in these human bodies, but that's not, our souls don't end there. You know, this is just one experience of ours. And I think the religious leaders who may have had trouble understanding him were misinterpreting this love as being purely an erotic kind of love. Mm. And I see that sometimes in the translations, this is why you hear Rumi read at all these weddings, right?
Right.
You're talking about the love between two human beings, and that's valid, and he wants to talk about that too, but he sees that as a reflection of divine love. Any pure love is a reflection of the divinity that we see within each other and ourselves.
Well, I sometimes wonder if those religious leaders in all traditions have misinterpreted, or if they absolutely understand precisely what he's saying and realize that there's nothing in it for me if you can be loved, if you can be loved for yourself. And if this love comes to you from your relationship with the all, then where's my 10%?
Right.
So I'm just saying.
Yeah.
But talk about the way the poetry works, because it's interesting. You've heard it. You heard it all your life. You were rolling your eyes for much of your life. And then something in your mind brought you to a different place.
Yeah.
Right? And from that moment forward, the words had a different meaning. I mean, let's talk about that fantastic phenomenon, that these words will mean one thing to someone who hasn't had that sense and evoke powerful feelings in others. How's that work? What's going on?
Yeah. I mean, I think the connection for me is when I lost my mind when I went manic. I was struck illiterate. And as somebody who's a lawyer and a writer and an avid reader, to not be able to read, I would look at a book and all of the letters would just fly all over the place.
How long did that go on?
Thankfully, only for a few days, but it was enough to terrify me. But at the same moment, it had happened just after this beautiful mystical experience. And that not being able to read allowed me to feel the poetry. So when my dad was reciting it for me, I wasn't using my intellect for it. I was using pure intuition and emotion. And I think all of us have that intuition. We just love to cover it up with things that we think the rest of the world wants to see, that we think looks better. And I'm certainly guilty of that. And even the process of trying to promote this book is such a weird, weird, weird thing, because, you know, I want this message out there. It's my child. I want it to be out in the world and for people to see it and read it. But I also don't like the idea of accumulating stuff. I don't like the idea of asking people to purchase something, especially like books are getting really expensive. Like I don't like that part of it at all. And what's made that possible for me to do with this book is partnering with the National Iranian American Council, which is the largest Iranian American organization, and works to protect the civil rights of Iranian Americans. It also works to promote peace and diplomacy. So I donated a lot of books and to them. And so that now if you donate to the National Iranian American Council up until May, you'll get a free copy of my book.
Oh. And you can find out more about that at our website, stateofthings.org. So, Melody, that's so fascinating to hear about, first of all, the fact that you realize what a problem this is, right? That you're going to have to sell a thing to tell people. Because that's what, and let me ask you how you feel about this. When people are looking for these experiences, they realize there's something very wrong with the way we're living our lives. And there must be something, another way to understand all this. The first instinct is to get something. You have to read a book or learn how to do something. And what you experience and what so many others experience is it's when you forget, it's when you let go of something and get it out of the way that the words suddenly, that you've been blinded by something because the words have always been there.
Yeah. Rumi has a poem where he says, "Zar talab gashti khod aval zar budi," which means you went out in search of gold far and wide, but all along you were gold on the inside. And that doesn't sell well. To say what you have inside is great. And what I hope people, you know, take solace in this poetry, but I also want them to go back to their inheritance, their background, their history, because there's something rich and deep in that. And I think going back to it, I learned that there isn't, you know, as somebody who I was born during the revolution and during the Iran-Iraq war, I grew up. And as someone who comes from that, to be able to say all of that trauma, you know, this intergenerational trauma people love talking about, it's absolutely valid. Our bodies feel it. But our bodies also, the fact that I've survived, that I'm here as the children of these immigrant Iranian Muslim parents, the fact that I'm here at all speaks to an intense level of intergenerational resilience. Mm. And that is the other side of this that we don't talk about. We'd love to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder and all of that, which exists, of course, but there's also a notion of post-traumatic growth, which only recently are we beginning to look into.
What about that tension in you as someone who is more or less raised in the United States and having to conform to American values as a school girl growing up, right? Now looking back, it seems to me you have a unique perspective on what it means to be raised in America when this is the air you breathe and the water you drink, and really no chance to reflect on the damage that can be done in a materialistic society like this without ever asking the child, you know, is this what you need?
Mm, yeah. I think the first chapter of the book revolves around wanting. And that's sort of where it comes from, is this wanting more. And we often talk about it as an American concept, and I think it is. But it's also just a human concept of wanting more and it never being enough. And, you know, I was able to write an essay adapted from this book for the New York Times last week. And I was excited about it. It could have been in the Sunday Review in print, but it didn't make it to Sunday. So, of course, it's not good enough for me that it made it in the New York Times last week. Why isn't it in the Sunday Review? So when I say, like, this is what I'm being tested right now, because a kind of thing coming on air, you know, this isn't what writing is about. And I love talking to you, and please have me back.
Yeah.
But this isn't what it's about. It's about that beautiful moment where you connect and are able to channel something greater than yourself. To put words on paper. And I love that I was able to come here after those wonderful musicians, because music has a way of doing that. Unfortunately, words are my skill. That's my talent, you know, that other things can't.
Well, let me ask you about that, about the translation, too, in that process, because that's always a delicate process, particularly when it comes to poetry and very particularly when it comes to mystical poetry like this.
Yeah. Often the... When it comes to Rumi, often the Islam is wiped clean of his poetry. And even my father was doing the translations at one point. There's a poem with the word Kaaba in it, and he wanted me to translate it as church because he said, your readers are mostly American, they're mostly Christian, that's what they'll understand.
And what should it have been?
Kaaba in Mecca, the house of God in Mecca. So, and that would have been, and I didn't want to do that. I was like, there's no way that I'm calling it church. Are you kidding? And his philosophy is, you know, and I'm part of writing this book is I just want people to stop hating us so much. And as Muslims, as Iranians, all of it, I just want them to stop. And my dad was like, don't worry about that. His philosophy is just keep talking about love. If you keep talking about love, that's all that matters. Eventually, they'll stop hating you, but that's not your goal. Your goal is to love yourself. Mm.
The big truth.
Yeah.
No matter how preposterous it is, if you tell the truth often enough, people will start to believe it.
Inshallah.
Melody Moisey is the author of The Rumi Prescription, How an Ancient Mystic Poet Changed My Modern Manic Life, also an attorney and visiting assistant professor at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, touring through Central North Carolina, going to be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow at 7, Flyleaf's Chapel Hill Monday, March 9th, Southern Pines March 11th, and Greensboro March 12th. If you missed that, or if you just want to see it again, go to our website, stateofthings.org. What a pleasure, Melody. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me.